My name is Graham, and I'm an alcoholic. This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so that it may better carry the message of AA, and since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals your addiction. Our literature persons, Keith Karif and Giro, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and your understanding. Jackie will read the preamble.
Hi, I'm Jackie. I'm an alcoholic. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God, Lauren will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic. 1, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. 2, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. 3, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. 4, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. 5, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. 6, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. 9, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Stacy will read the traditions.
Stacy, grateful alcoholic.
Looking for the traditions here.
The 12 traditions. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself, and our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion, that we need always maintain personal anonymity at a level of press, radio, and film. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by an information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Barbara.
Hello, I'm Barbara, an alcoholic. I'd like to give thanks to God for being here and to my sober family that's over on aisle 12. What it's like, what it was like, and what it's like now. I'm going to divide my story into two sections, the pre-Atlantic Group section and the now section. I was raised in Monmouth County. I'm speaking to the microphone. In Bruce Springsteen country, but I never met him. It was a Levitt development. There were 1,200 homes built or so, and 3 of them were occupied by black people, or in those days, Negro people. So I felt very different very early on. We were very different. There were 3 families, and we were one of them. Everyone had a new home. There was no grass, because the grass came later. There were planks leading up to the front door. And no one had any furniture because it was everyone's first home. So we had no furniture longer because we were poor. I had a brother, and his name was Brian. And Brian was also different. Brian probably had had some form of mental illness, probably Asperger's syndrome, but we didn't know what it was then. We just called him odd, and my father would say, he has a problem. But we didn't know what that was. So we traipsed along there in our Levitt development house, growing with trees. It was idyllic. It was really beautiful. But it was unlike any other black family in the 60s was living, probably. And what we knew, what my family would say, is that, you know, we're doing this and we're supposed to be a credit to the race. That's what our job is. And you are a credit to the race if you walk out that door and you look well and you speak well, except that Brian wasn't speaking. So in terms of doing the job of being a credit to the race, fell firmly on me, even though it wasn't said that way. And it was just very, very confusing because no one talked about why Brian wasn't speaking. No one told me why. And my family would have these conversations about nothing but whether they were Negro, colored, or whether they were Negroes, and then whether we were black. And Grandma and Grandpa didn't want to be black. And that's where it stopped. That's when I left home. But I was just very confused about what was going on in my life and why I was in an entirely black white neighborhood all the time. And as I inched into middle school and the black students saw me and had never laid eyes on me before and wondered where I came from and then immediately hated me. And so there was this, like, I'm supposed to be like them, but I have all these other folks that are like me, but they're not like me, but they're my friends and I've known them forever, except the few that hate me. But it was just very, very confusing. And could I ask my brother about any of this? Absolutely not. Brian wasn't talking, you know. So I just kind of was continuing to feel less than, scared. Depression was kind of creeping in. I also was a slightly heavy, chubby child, as they called them. I had to go to the Sears chubby section. But then my mother, in good housekeeping, found out Weight Watchers and about steaming vegetables. And I dropped 30 pounds like that. And then I went from 7th grade being Baby Huey to being Raquel Welch in the 8th grade. And all of a sudden, the black guys or the colored guys or the Negro boys who didn't like me, I think they were between black and Negro, they didn't like me. All of a sudden, they loved me. And there was no roadmap as to what this young lady was supposed to do with this activity. I didn't know how to fend it off. Unfortunately, there was a unfortunate incident that probably would have resulted in jail time for somebody, but it didn't. I never told anybody about it in those days. But that kind of opened the door to early sexuality for me, and that early sexuality continued continued until it wasn't Erling anymore. Thank God. However, because I didn't tell anybody, I just had a lot of shame and a lot of fear and a lot of yearning. That was just a hole that would never be filled. But that feeling of discomfort and still not being able to talk, because Brian still wasn't talking very much. Brian was teaching himself German. Brian was listening to rock and roll, which everyone else was listening to R&B. Brian was just different. When I went into college, I was introduced to alcohol, and I knew I had alcoholics on both sides of my family, but the alcoholics in the family were not credits to their race. They were morally deficient, and that's why they drank, and that's why they died in flop houses, or that's why they were prostitutes, because they were just no doggone good. I was good, and therefore I couldn't be an alcoholic. However, I did get alcohol poisoning, and if you're new or coming back, that means blackouts, that means puking, that means peeing in your pants. Those are all the signs of alcoholic poisoning, and even though I was in college, I was doing those things. Let's fast forward it since I have 5 minutes. So I was at Kent State in Ohio going to college. I was still had a deep sense of yearning, a deep sense of uncomfortability with myself, and I was binge drinking. I was not a daily drinker. I was not a morning drinker, but I was kind of developing a system. I would try champagne, which they had back in those days. I would try Yago. I know it's a blast from the past. Yago Sangria. But unfortunately, because I'm an alcoholic, the compulsion to drink would happen. I would not know when to stop. I would not know that I should stop, and therefore I would poison myself with alcohol, and I would do things that were shameful. When I woke up, to kill the shame, I'd have to use the alcohol. The alcohol was the solution. Even though I was in Kent, Ohio, which is 30 minutes from Akron, Ohio, AA was never mentioned. No, it was a drinking problem at a college. I went to Syracuse University for a master's degree, still very, very sick, diminished, yearning, just barely getting by, and knowing that I was not doing what my parents wanted to. Part of me loved them, part of me hated them, because they had expectations for me, and they were loved. They're still loved greatly. They're 80 years old, and they are just the joy of their community, but they were not the joy of my life. Because they couldn't give me an answer. I hadn't answered them any questions, but they hadn't given me answers in years and years. I just didn't know how to talk to them. I didn't know how to talk to anybody. I was working full-time to either be like you, to not be like me, to hide my shame, or to figure out what to do tomorrow night. And what was the formula? What was the great thing to drink that was going to make this all settle down? When did I get the roses? When did I get the Rolls Royce? They were all on the commercials, and I wasn't getting any of that stuff. I was getting sicker and sicker. This is a women's story, so there's depression in it. There's an eating disorder in it. And there's running marathons and everything. There's being a vegetarian. I tried everything. There's being a feminist, because feminists can do what they want to do. They can drink like men. They can sleep around like men. Maybe that was the answer. That wasn't the answer. I came back to New York, lived with my parents for a while, and the alcohol poisoning and the compulsion to drink was really there. I remember going to a party, one of my first jobs, I went to the party, drank so much, and ate a lot of carrots. So you know at the end of the evening what that was like. It wasn't pretty. But my solution was I wasn't drinking enough. I really didn't have a solution, and I'm a mental health professional, but no one mentioned the disease of alcoholism, or even better, that there is a solution and that men and women were getting sober all around me. So eventually I went to a reunion up in Syracuse for the wrong reasons, did the wrong things, and finally came back and said, and I was by this time married a year, had met this great guy, but I was still lost and scared and holding on to trying to be, just holding on to these feelings of less than, always wanting to be like you, never being wanting to be like me, and deep seething anger for my family, my credit to the race kind of family who really were doing the right thing. But I just couldn't talk to them, and I was very angry that I couldn't tell them what was really going on. They didn't ask what was really going on, but I couldn't tell them. Now let's keep it on me. So came back from Syracuse and said, I've got a problem. And I had heard about these AA meetings. So in Syracuse, I went to an AA meeting. I came back to Hoboken and went to an AA meeting. And there it was a small room. It wasn't a room like this. And there were lots of folks who weren't like me, but I had no place else to go. I was desperate. And I figured this Alcoholics Anonymous, they must have the secret. They must know the formula. You know, because I said, well, I can't drink when I have my period. And I tried olive oil and I tried greasy food. I tried 3 drinks 3 days a week. I tried light liquor, dark liquor, and nothing was working. Maybe they'll have the secret. If I'm good and I hold hands and say the prayers, they'll tell me what I'm supposed to drink. And then after a few days, I said, wait a minute, some people aren't drinking here. So there isn't really time for me to tell what all happened in JG, but I will tell you that my dear odd brother died a few years ago, and a tragic time for my life, and at a very young age, and I was lost. I hadn't been working the steps. I'd been on the fringes of the meeting, and I give credit to Commuter Special. I give credit to the mansion in Jersey City, but I was able not to work the steps for a really long time because I was just too dang smart for them. And I just stayed away from them as long as I possibly could. I was afraid. I was full of fear. And when I got on my knees and when someone from Atlanta Group asked me to speak at the meeting, even knowing who I was and I hadn't worked the steps, they asked me to come to the meeting. And I went to a meeting where I could actually see people, and they were smiling and dressed in suits. And we had stopped smoking, so I really could see everyone in the room. And I said, well, maybe I'll ask them for a sponsor, because I really hadn't had a sponsor. And they got me Debbie Young, who is my sponsor today. And she worked the steps with me. And just in time for my brother's death was tragic. There was a trial involved, and I was working the fourth step just prior to going into the court to with my family, which I now love, to get a guilty verdict and have the bums that hurt him get convicted. So it's a happy ending. If you knew we're coming around, it's never too late to work the steps. You can have many sobrieties just like I did. You cannot drink and go to meetings just like I did, but don't forget the steps. Thank you.
That's it. Our second 10-minute speaker is Jim.
Hello, my name is Jim, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you, Barbara. This is my home group, the Atlantic Group. George McAlpine is my sponsor, and my sobriety date is March 21, 2007. And I'm very grateful to be working the steps again with my sponsees, Lance, Sean, and Elizabeth. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was blessed to grow up in a loving home. My mother and father were not drinkers. There was no alcohol in our home. And I had my first drink when I was 17. I had a lot of friends growing up, being an only child. My friends were really my extended family, and they still are to this day. And when my best friend gave me this cocktail, I said, well, what is that? It looks like a watered-down Coke. And he said, well, drink it, Jim. It'll make you feel really good. And I said, well, I already feel good. And he said, well, drink it anyway. And I smelled it. I thought it smelled awful. And I tasted it, and I hated it. And I didn't see the point. So I got into college, and I started going to some frat parties, and you don't order a Coke at a frat party, so I started standing around with a beer in my hand, and I didn't really like it, but I stood there with it and occasionally took a sip, and I was having a great time. After college, I got a job with an airline, and I started flying to international destinations, and what I noticed was that all of the crew members were going in and buying these huge bottles of alcohol. And I thought, what are they going to do with all that liquor? What would anybody need that much liquor? And I didn't get it. And so I'm grown now, and I'm hanging out in New York. I was being invited out to do fun things in the city, and going to dinner a lot, and invited into people's homes for a beverage, an adult beverage, before dinner. And I liked it. It was nice. I liked the coziness. I liked the intimacy of being in my friends' homes, getting to know them better. And there were always spirits available. And I started drinking martinis. And I decided in 1992, when I could afford my own apartment in the city, that I would have a bar too. And I did. And I could entertain in my home. And what started happening was that I started making nightcaps at night when I would get home from my fun times with my friends. And I didn't see any harm in it. Everyone drank responsibly that I knew. And what happened was that I started waking up, not having gone to bed and having terrible hangovers, but making it to work. And I would be really edgy on the job. And I realized to get rid of that edge, I could have a drink at work. And so I started drinking at work. And Something happened to me in July of 04. I couldn't quit drinking. It was Monday morning. It was time for me to go back to work, and I couldn't quit. And I had to call in sick. And the next Monday came, I was still drinking. And then the next Monday came, and I was still drinking. And I was in shock, really. I couldn't believe that this was happening. And I called my doctor, and he medically detoxed me. And since I had been out of work for 21 days, they required a doctor's note to get an excused absence. And so my doctor filled the paperwork out. He sent it to the company, to Corporate Medical. And then they called me and said, you have to go to the Employee Assistance Program. And then the Employee Assistance Program insisted I go to AA meetings and see an addiction therapist. I went to one AA meeting so I could lie really well if I was quizzed on how my AA meetings were going. I thought they were all the same. I had no idea they were different formats. He never quizzed me. He was an addict himself, 30-something years in recovery, and he knew what was sitting in front of him, thank God. And I continued to drink that for a full year, and I really was suffering a great deal. I went on many binges. I was getting professionally detoxed countless times, and I decided that maybe I should go to my second AA meeting a year later, July of 05. And I called a guy that I had met at my first meeting, and he invited me to the Atlantic Group. And I didn't know anything about the Atlantic Group. I tried to stay away from AA as much as possible. And so he introduced me to step work. And so we started doing the steps, and I continued to drink. And I might get to, I was in here for 2 years counting days in this room. I thought it was never going to end, and I know a lot of you in here thought it was never going to end. But I had to keep coming back to this same room because I couldn't be anonymous in AA. As sick as I was, there were some basics that I did know. And one of those was that I couldn't be a shadow in AA. I really had to come back and own my choice to drink again and keep counting days with the people that I knew and that the people that really had a solution. And I might get 3 weeks and I would drink again. We were getting through the steps little by little on my sober, or the times I wasn't drinking. I only got sober once. And I was winding up in detoxes and beating up guards to get out of them. They were beating up me. I was being ambulanced to hospitals, put in intensive care units. My doctor said my liver was showing early signs of cirrhosis of the liver, and my resting heart rate was about to jump out. My heart was about to jump out of my chest. I was very bloated, and working the steps with a sponsor and still drinking. And I got out of the hospital one particular time from the intensive care unit, and my sponsor said, Jim, are you praying? And I said, pray to what? And he said, Jim, alcohol is killing you. Will it kill you to pray? And I remembered that when I was ready to stop drinking, because after I got out of the hospital, I had I had been physically detoxed. So the physical compulsion was gone, but the mental obsession had crept into my a progressive addiction. And I couldn't get rid of that mental obsession to drink, even though I had been physically detoxed. And so I was drinking. And I thought, okay, I'm drinking beer and wine because I don't want to go to the hospital, but I can't stop drinking. And I realized that, yes, what I had denied for so long, that little ounce of liquid, I'm powerless over this. I can't quit drinking, and I don't think I'm going to ever breathe another sober breath. So I really experienced the gift of desperation, as we talk about here in these rooms. And I did step one right there. I came in on the unmanageability part, but I fully did step one. And, okay, so now what? What do I do now? I'm drunk. I can't get sober. I'm on these medications that detox me, but I have this mental obsession to drink. So my sponsor had told me, you go to God. That's where you go. Step two. So I came to believe, and believe me, I believe. I begged God, I had one beer left, please let it be the last. I got in the bed, and I said, okay, I'm yours, and I will do whatever my sponsor says. And that was a Tuesday morning. So that was steps one, two, and three. I implemented them into my life. I stay with them. I've not looked back yet. And I came here that Tuesday night. I got in the bed at 5 a.m. That's when I had my last drink on March 20th, 2007. That was a Tuesday. I came in here, and I watched all your day counters. And every one of you had more time than me. And I was so grateful to be in a room with people in the beginning of their recovery and being very visible. So I want to thank the day counters in advance. It's a phenomenal service that you do, giving your day count. It saved my life, and it allowed me to really focus on what I needed to do that night, which was not to drink anymore. And hopefully the next day I would have day one, and I did. And so I was able to get into step four with my sponsor eventually. We did all, you know, steps one, two, and three again. And then I did four, and I did five, and I hated it. People said, you'll be so relieved when you do five. But I wasn't. I looked at all my defects of character, my resentments, my part in them, and I hated it. And my sponsor said, just relax, Jim. And then we did six, and I said, oh, you mean I can go to God, and I can become ready to ask God to remove all this mess in step four, and that I just went over with in step five, thank you. And he said, yeah, just keep reading, or he kept reading to me. And so I said, well, can we go ahead and do seven, because I'm really ready. I want to give it over. And so we did, and that was the first time I experienced serenity in this program. And it was such a blessing. And I was with Robin that night, and we were talking, and I said, you know, when I got sober, and she said, Jim, did you hear what you said? I said, yeah, I said, when I got sober, I said, Robin, I think I've got it. And she said, yeah, Jim, you've got it today, and that's wonderful. So, yeah, it took me 6 months to have any faith that I was really a man being sober and working the program. So then I did eight and nine, and again, I had the spiritual condition, the spiritual foundation to do eight and nine, as well as AA teaches us to do it. And it was all about my part and me cleaning up my part. And I knew if other people couldn't forgive me, that I had forgiven myself and that I was a changed man. And it was okay. So then I began living in the maintenance steps of 10, 11, and 12. My time is up. We share time in here. Thank you all for my sobriety.
Main speaker tonight is Jessamay.
Hello. Hi, everyone. My name is Jessamay. I'm an alcoholic. Thrilled to be here. I'm thrilled to be sober. Jeff, thank you so much for asking me. It's an honor and a privilege to speak at an AA meeting. My home group is the Park West group, all the way over in Brooklyn. We meet on Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday nights. If you're ever in the neighborhood, you all are most welcome. We'd love to see you. My sobriety date is January 30th, 1994, and I am sober by the grace of God and the fellowship of AA for sure. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I am really what you would call a garden variety alcoholic, and what that means for me is that there really is nothing special about the way that I drank, and there's nothing special about the circumstances I ended up in. It's just kind of what happens to a teenage girl that drinks. And, you know, long before my path crossed with alcohol, I believe for me, I had the beginnings of that spiritual illness, that spiritual malady that our literature talks about of alcoholism. I think that really speaks to me in how I was. Even before I picked up a drink, I was so self-centered. I was like consumed with what, like me, my, how was I going to get mine? How could I manipulate you to get mine? And, you know, what were you going to do for me? Long before, and I was extremely uncomfortable. You know, I was really motivated by fear and this extreme sense of self long before I picked up a drink. And I think, you know, I managed that in the ways that I could. Like, I mean, I remember like when I was 12, I like dusted my room like compulsively. Like it was really weird. My parents didn't understand it, but it was like, I was like wound up so tight. I mean, I was thinking about it. It was like, you know, I was like a soda can and I was just, oh, just add alcohol. I mean, that was really the story, is like, just add booze. And I'll tell you, I, you know, grew up in alcoholism. I believe this certainly is a family disease, and I'm truly grateful for the program of Al-Anon, because I believe the prayers of someone in Al-Anon got me to AA. The prayers of a lot of people, but certainly those were very helpful. So there I was, like, you know, wound up really, really tight, and knowing all about the disease of alcoholism. I'd done a stint in Alateen. I could tell you about, you know, blah, blah, blah. I had this piece of Alateen literature called What's Drunk, Mama? So, like, I knew all this, like, stuff about, I knew about it, let me tell you. And, but this is the thing, like, I knew the horror show of alcoholism. Like, I saw it, I knew it, lived it. But this is the crazy, crazy feature of my alcoholism. Regardless of what information I have, a drink is still a good idea. And, that was it. It was, you know, I was, you know, one of my passions was dancing. I studied classical ballet. I was obsessed with it in that way that somebody's wound up really, really tight can be obsessed with things. And, I was just, it was like single-minded focus. And I, like I said, this discomfort, this like spiritual malaise, this like, oh, like I gotta get out was just building and building and building. And what happened was, it was like my path crossed with alcohol, and nobody had to say, this is how you do it. You know, I like intuitively knew that the name of the game was to drink as much as possible, as quickly as possible. I was drinking for effect. I was not drinking, you know, to have a few cocktails and loosen up. And it was like, I went from like this little like bunhead of like wearing, I mean, really like dorky, like pink sweater clothes in like eighth grade, where everyone else was like getting all cute and getting boys to notice them. I was like this like little dork wearing all pink. I went from that to like black nail polish, a bottle of Jack Daniels, like, and a Marlboro Red, like, boom. And I was in like an all-girl heavy metal band. It was really, but I mean, like, you know, band rehearsal, like, I use that very loosely. It was like, well, who's gonna go to the package store for us? Like, that was kind of like what rehearsal was. We'd have these like grand ideas. We'd like, you know, whip out a couple like Ramones covers, and then I'd be like, okay, when, you know, where's the booze? Where's the booze? Where's the booze? That was always like my question. When are we gonna drink? When are we gonna drink? When are we gonna drink? And you know, one thing about me and alcohol is that I heard a speaker say this recently. Like, if I knew, it might have been, you know, I think it might have been one of I think it might have been Michael that spoke at Park West recently, and he said, if I knew the drink was coming, I could relax. And that's the way it was with me. It was like, oh my gosh, I have to get a drink, I have to get a drink. And what happened was, you know, people would kind of like dilly dally or be like, oh, let's like go do something else, and we'll do this before we go to the store. And I mean, I would be like fingernails in my palms, like, I need a drink now, you don't understand. So needless to say, like, any kind of activity that didn't involve drinking quickly went by the wayside. Like, I mean, you know, I started drinking, like, I immediately gained a ton of weight, like, I couldn't dance, you know, I couldn't do anything, like, I couldn't show up. Like, it was like I started sleeping all day, like, everything. I almost immediately became, like, disinterested in life, in my life, and it was like this single-minded focus of where's the next drink. And, you know, I just, all of my time and energy went into like scheming, planning, plotting, where's the next drink, where's the next drink, where's the next drink. Like I said, you know, any kind of like quote unquote band I was in, that went by the wayside. And you know, I immediately, from the beginning, I started to pay a price to drink. And I didn't know what that was. You know, I didn't know like what that price was, but you know, looking back, I can see how it just kept on getting higher and higher. Because the thing is with those, like, lines in the sand that we draw, it's like, okay, this is as far as I'm going to go. And then it's like, go beyond it. And then this is, okay, this is it. And then go beyond it. And the denial was so thick around that. Like, I couldn't even acknowledge that that's what was happening. So, I mean, and this is the thing about recovery that's so beautiful is that, you know, like our literature talks about when another alcoholic is, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, is planted in the mind of another, the true nature of his malady will never be the same again. And that's kind of what happened to me. I knew about AA, you know, before my drinking was ruined before I picked up a drink, unfortunately. Like, it sucked. Like, I can't even tell you, because I knew there was another way of life. Like, I knew that there was another way. And I would, you know, get drunk and I would be weepy and like, oh, I'm so, you know, this, that, or the other thing. Or I would get drunk and be rageful and, you know, hurt people that cared about me. I mean, I think that, like, I say this quite often, but the short version of my story is, you know, I drank, I got drunk, I threw up, I hurt people that loved me, and I just kept on doing it over and over and over and over. And my best solution, you know, the answer to everything was to drink. It was like a drink was always a good idea. So, you know, what happened? So there I was kind of like mucking around in my life. My aspirations had, you know, had been reduced to like a mini fridge. Like, that's all I wanted was like a mini fridge that I could put a case of Busch Light in because I drank the good stuff. It was like, that was my wildest dream. That was like, that was as big as I dreamed. And it was like a wood paneled mini fridge too, which made it kind of cool. So that was it. Like, that was, I just wanted all of you to leave me alone so I could drink it the way that I wanted to. And like I said, thank goodness for Al-Anon, because, you know, my mother had been elevated to black belt Al-Anon status by that point, and you know, loved me when I couldn't love myself, and also, you know, said to me at a certain point, I'm never going to give up on you. And that is a tremendous, tremendous gift. What happened was she applied to college for me. I remember she came to me with a college application, said, sign on the X. And I signed on the X. I think I wrote an essay about my hair. Like, that was like, that might have been my contribution. It was about how, like, my hair reflected my inner persona and how deep I was. And, like, you know, because I was an artist. So off I went to college. And, you know, by the way, I had all the, like, theatrics and, you know, car accidents, emergency rooms. Like, I had all that. Like, that was all, I mean, there was, like, day glow fluorescent flags along the way. Like, it wasn't red flags. Like, it was, like, flashing lights along the way. And so, you know, off I went to this school that, you know, I knew that you could get booze there. Like, that's all I knew. I knew that there would be booze. And when I discovered it, I was like, oh, you can get drunk on a Tuesday morning, because there's, like, you know, my mother wasn't, like, checking my breath when I walked in the door anymore. And, you know, it was kind of just like, it was like a go. Like, I just did what I always did, which was just drank. It was the answer to all my problems. You know, needless to say, academics were not a priority. I was in way over my head. Like, I hadn't studied in high school. I just kind of skated by on, I mean, I don't know what, on my wits. I mean, I don't know how that happened. So there I am, like, totally in over my head, like, wanting to die almost every day. I mean, there was, like, there was no light in my life at all. There was no, I didn't have, you know, connections with other people. I kind of had, like, acquaintances with people. Like, if you had something I wanted or needed, i.e. booze, then you were in my life. And once that was gone, you know, I had no need for you. I think I tried to, like, you know, pretend like I did, but there was no, it was just a hollow, hollow, empty, empty place. And so a couple things happened. And I think this is, you know, to me, the best part in everyone's story is that part where, like, you know, it's like grace. I mean, for me, like, it really, I am a girl that cannot say no to a drink. Like, a drink always sounded like a good idea. It didn't matter if there was one or five or 10 or, like, unlimited. I just, like, if it, I mean, I would have, like, licked it off the floor if I thought there was going to be some effect. So I had a couple things happen, and I think for me what happens is, you know, I have a very kind and loving God that I was unaware of, and, you know, I had this one roommate who was, like, so cool. Like, I mean, I was kind of a train wreck at this point, like, totally had ceased, like, putting together any sort of, like, outfits or, you know, anything. Like, there was no need for anything other than drinking. Like, everything had to be very utilitarian and drink ready. But I had this roommate who was like this, you know, she was like from like a city, and she was really cool, and she was like really punk, and she was like real punk, like not like pretend, like mall punk. And she had like a mohawk, and she was like this tall, and I really wanted her to think I was cool. But I was, and she just told me on a daily basis that I was drunk and I was miserable to be around. And it baffled me, because she had like friends that would like knock on our door at like 4 a.m. that were drunk. And I just wouldn't understand. Like, I was like, what's the problem? So, but I mean, as I'm like, she has this like wine that she bought as a kind of as a gag. It was like this really old, gross wine. And she had had like one little cup, and I was like, are you going to drink the rest of that? Like, any booze that she left in the room, I was like, are you going to drink the rest of that? Can I finish that? So she was there, you know, chirping in my ear. And then I had a really dear friend that ended up calling me from a psych ward and saying that he'd found Alcoholics Anonymous. And that like threw me off. I was not expecting that. So that kind of put a wrench in my ideas about myself. So I think for me, you know, like when I look back, I can see how, my higher powers kind of laying it down in a way that was easy for me to hear. It was like, the willingness, it was like I was being pried open. And, you know, so that happened. And then I was taking a women's study class when I hit bottom. I was trying feminism as a reason to drink. I was living way out in the boondocks, and, I was like just holding on, like, you know, I had nobody left in my life. Anyone that had like bought booze for me or like hung around or kind of been in my life had been long gone, because they'd gotten sick of all of my antics. So there I was out in the boondocks. It was like the middle of winter. It was like blizzards and snowstorms, and all I was eating was like that orange Kraft macaroni and cheese that I would buy from Cumberland Farms, and I was drinking just as much as I could. And the times that I wasn't drinking, I was just wanting to die. Like, that was really, I mean, that was what my existence had been reduced to, is just drinking and wanting to die. You know, the gift of desperation that Jim mentioned, I really believe I was given, that was a gift. That was a real, real gift for me. So what happened? And like I said, this is the magical part of our stories. This is like the place where it just takes my breath away when I think about it. So I remember I talked, the final thing that happened that I think contributed, it was my higher power speaking to me, is I have a family member that's been sober. And I spoke to him and I said, what do you do if you're an alcoholic? And I was hoping that he was going to assure me that I was not an alcoholic and, you know, that I could just go about my business. But instead he said, well, you go to AA and see how it feels. And I was like, oh, drats. So what happened was, you know, I still tried to drink. I still had to see if I could make it work, give it the old college try. And what happened was I had a drunk, and it was like any other drunk. There was nothing, you know, there was no emergency rooms. There was no fireworks. It was just kind of I found myself drunk again, and I didn't understand how I had gotten there. And it wasn't like physically where I was. It was like, not this again. Like, I really experienced that I did not want to go here. And here I am again. And suddenly there was no, you know, I didn't have the answer. Like, I'd always had the, oh, well, yeah, I'll just do this. Or yeah, I'll just adjust this. Or I was out of answers. And I believe I said my first honest prayer, which was just, I don't know. And I came to the next day, and, you know, this is a gift. This is a tremendous gift. I sat up in bed, and I looked at my too-cool-for-school roommate, and I said, I think I'm an alcoholic. And, I mean, she didn't care. Like, she was like, yeah, so. And then, so then I, you know, I quickly, you know, I called my parents, and I was weeping, and I said, I'm an alcoholic, crying, and they said, yeah, so what are you gonna do about it? You know, like, no, everyone was kind of like, was kind of sick of the game, sick of the angle. And so I said, this is grace, because this is not what I would have normally said. I said, I'm gonna go to AA. And so I then, you know, I spent the afternoon preparing for this new venture. You know, I was an artist, so I shaved my head because it was like performance art, you know. I was getting ready. It was a new life, very symbolic. So there I arrived, you know, on the doorstep of Alcoholics Anonymous. Shaved head. It was the middle of January, too. It was very weather-friendly. So I had to buy a watch cap. So I arrived, black watch cap, no makeup. I was wearing, like, a military overcoat that fit a six-pack and a pint really nicely. I wore combat boots, no makeup, no jewelry, no nothing that required any assembly. It was all like, you know, elasticized waist, XXXL turtlenecks to the knees, you know, utilitarian drinking clothes. So there I arrived. Oh yeah, and I used to like draw on myself too. That was my other thing. I rock and draw and cry in early sobriety. So there I arrived. And you know, I have to tell you, this is what happened. You all welcomed me with open arms and that unconditional love. Like, nobody, you know, nobody said I spilt more than you drank. People just said, come on in. What's your name? Glad you're here. Coffee's in the kitchen. You know, I really, I am so grateful for the fellowship that existed before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I remember those people, and it literally, it's just, when you greet someone, it's like the power of that is tremendous. So, you know, nobody asked me any invasive questions. They just kind of let me, like, shuffle around. I had my portfolio because I was an artist. And, you know, shuffle around, draw on myself, cry. And I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And what happened was the people that had the light in their eye and the spring in their step and, you know, the women that were really beautiful and, you know, were all like ladies, and I felt like just a scrappy drunk. They all talked about the 12 steps, and you know, just like Barbara and Jim were talking about, that was what I heard was the solution. And you know, this woman, Pam, who brought me on a journey through the 12 steps, she was a lady. She was not like me at all. She was not punk rock at all. She was like, she had like a hairdo and, you know, jewelry, clothes that matched, socks, furniture, like just things that like baffled me. Like I was like, I don't get it. Did laundry on a regular basis, had a dog, husband. Like, I mean, it was like calculus, you know? Like I was in like 2 + 2. Like that's where I was in terms of life. So she brought me on a journey through the steps, and she gave me the most tremendous gift, which is a relationship with a power greater than myself. And I am eternally grateful to her and the women that helped her. I am so grateful for the people all along the way that have, you know, given me their time, given me rides. I didn't have a car for the first 3 years I got sober, and I lived in a town where you had to drive to go to meetings, and I would go, we would all meet at this ice cream parlor drunks and ice cream, right? So I'd be like standing there for hours, like hours and hours. You'd go an hour before the meeting and be, you know, the meeting before the meeting, and then the meeting on the way to the meeting, and then the actual meeting, and then on the way back, and all this like smoking cigarettes, talking to people. I just threw myself into AA to the best of my ability. I really, like, there was no, you know, I was not getting invited anywhere. You know, like, this was like, this was just a wonderful invitation, Alcoholics Anonymous. And people got me involved in the group. You know, my first commitment was somebody told me, you're going to do cleanup. And I was so excited. Like, it was like, I, like, wrote commitment on my calendar. Like, I was just, like, ecstatic to be included. And, yeah, this guy, Justin, was the cleanup guy ahead of me. And, like, he would, like, walk around with a mop, and I would follow him. And I'd be like, can I do something? Can I do something? And he wouldn't let me do anything, of course. So, but I was just, I was thrilled to be a part of. And I would go to the meetings early, and, you know, and I would stay late. And, you know, I would try to talk to people. I mean, for me, like, early sobriety was, like, everything I said, I felt like I was, like, putting my foot in my mouth. I mean, sometimes still in social situations, I'm like, oh, why did I say that? You know, it's that self-centered fear kicking up. But I just, I was, like, awkward. I was all elbows and knees in early sobriety. And, you know, it would be, like, one minute I'd be like, I can't believe I'm alive. I'm so grateful. And then the next I'd be like, oh, my God, I want to die. So it was like... if you're on that roller coaster, it's normal. I mean, for me, like, booze was like everything. It was like my best friend. It was like my boyfriend. It was my parent. Booze was everything. So it was like suddenly there was like this really big cavernous place inside. And that has been filled by, you know, a relationship with a power greater than myself and by the fellowship. So, you know, what happened? Like I said, I got involved. I got a home group. Everything I heard in my first AA meeting was everything I needed that I still do. You know, I got a home group. I got a service commitment. I got a sponsor. And I tried to reach my hand out. There was this clubhouse in the town next to the town I got sober in. And they had that, you know, Dr. Bob's prescription pad, don't drink, clean house, help others. And that is like the formula for me. That's what I try to do today. So, you know, and this is the thing about life is that it keeps on happening after you get sober. It's not like I got sober, that's the end of the story, you know, grew my hair out, dyed it blonde, started wearing girl clothes. No, it like goes on and on. You know, I got sober and I managed to, you know, finish school sober. You know, I had to get a job sober. I had to like figure out how to do laundry sober. I had to figure out how to go to the dentist sober. There's all this like new life stuff to try. And so I kind of like, with the help of, you know, people in Alcoholics Anonymous, like took me by the hand and showed me how to live as a sober woman. I did that. And then, you know, I started to like have these ideas of, oh, maybe I can do something. And I would say, I want to move to New York City. And I would just like talk about it and complain about it and talk about it. And the thing is if you complain about something long enough in AA, people tell you to shut up and take an action. So that's what happened. People said, so when are you moving to New York City? So, you know, I was, that was like my sober dream. I mean, way bigger than a mini fridge. And so I moved to New York and, you know, was able to like return to dancing and return to performing and just, you know, just all these beautiful things like that. And it's not necessarily about that. For me to not drink today is enough. Like that is enough. If that's all that ever happens, that is just good. But the thing with the 12 steps and the fellowship is that there's so much more. So I was able to do that. And, then, you know, I kind of got burnt on the city and I was like, I'm going to try the West Coast. And, you know, this is the thing. Like, you can, my sponsor said to me, my very first sponsor, Pam, said, geographic, schmeographic, just go to meetings wherever you are. And that's what I did. So I've had home groups, you know, in Massachusetts. I've had home groups in New York City. I've had home groups in Seattle, Washington. It's pretty beautiful. And, you know, the great thing is then when you go to, like, you know, say the international convention, you know, drunks from all over the country and it's like old home week. So it's really wonderful. I've had a lot of adventures. So, you know, I've had a lot of different jobs. I've had a lot of different careers and, you know, it's just, to me, this is the benchmark for my day, no matter what is going on, is did I drink? And that's it. Like, to me, that my primary purpose is to stay sober and help another alcoholic. The most important thing in my life has already happened to me. And that is, you know, that God stepped in and, you know, truth and honesty collided. And I saw myself for whom what I really was, which is a drunk. And I'm so, so grateful for that. So, you know, and like I said, the life continues to happen. So I was able to, you know, have a wonderful experience out in Seattle. I did not like it so much on the West Coast and Pacific Northwest, but I'm way too like fast. I decided to talk too fast. People got confused. So I was like too high energy. So I moved back, and you know, that was a fun adventure in itself. And I didn't have to drink like through all of it. And like the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous was there. And you know, the big thing that happened to me recently is, you know, I met a man on the AA campus and love followed at first sight. And there you go. So now I'm getting married in April of next year, which is like, I mean, who knew? I did not know. And that to me is a whole other amazing adventure of like participating in life. Like, this is the thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has afforded me, is it's freed me from this like obsession, this deadly obsession, to allow me to participate in my life. So I've been able to show up for all kinds of things. You know, I recently joined the Park West group because I was kind of floating. I didn't have a home group. I wasn't really ready to let go of my home group in Manhattan. But I know that for me, that's like the anchor. I need to have a place where I can know who's new. And that's why I have a home group, because I can recognize the newcomer. That's the thing that was driven home to me, is that through all of this, like I said, my responsibility is to stay sober and to help another alcoholic. And the precious thing that we have here is we have the ability to save each other's lives. Like, that's something you don't get to do in the outside world. There are people who have given me something so deep and so profound. The healing that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is tremendous. So, you know, I'd like to say, if you're new or if you're, you know, having trouble staying sober, please just keep coming. This is a way of life. This is a blueprint for living that really, really works. And I was talking with someone this weekend, and they were reminding me that, you know, the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Like, this is about me going out there and suiting up, showing up, and putting spiritual principles in all my affairs. And it's not always easy, but it's just, it's a beautiful, beautiful life. And the other thing, I'll just close with this, is, you know, one of my favorite, I have a lot of favorite lines, but in the 12 and 12, the last line of the 12th step says, you know, the joy of living is the theme of AA's 12th step, and action is its key word. And that to me is what this really is. What we do here in AA is the joy of living. So thank you very much for having me.